Chapter 23. Dr. Kevin Bew peered at the blackening sky to the west and grimaced. Only hours earlier, the sun had shone brightly and the air was still while the mercury in the thermometer tickled 20 degrees Fahrenheit. But then the barometer had dropped like a stone in a well, accompanied by a gradual building of the westerly winds. A quarter of a mile away, the gray waters of the Arctic now rolled in deep swells that burst against the ragged edge of the ice pack with billowing fountains of spray. Tugging the hood of his parka tighter, he turned away from the stinging winds and surveyed his home over the last few weeks. Ice Research Lab 7 wouldn't rate many stars in the mobile travel guide for luxury or comfort. A half-dozen prefabricated buildings made up the camp, huddled in a semicircle with their entrances facing south. Three tiny bunkhouses were jammed together on one side next to the largest building, a combination galley, mess hall, and meeting area. A squat structure just opposite housed a joint lab and radio room, while a snow-covered storage shed rounded out the camp at the far end. The research lab was one of several Canadian Fisheries and Oceans Department temporary ice camps established as floating research labs to track and study the movements of the Arctic ice pack. Since the time Ice Research Lab 7 had been set up a year earlier, the camp had moved nearly 200 miles, riding a mammoth sheet of polar ice south across the Beaufort Sea. Now positioned 150 miles from the North American coastline, the camp sat on the edge of the ice shelf, almost due north of the Yukon Territory. The camp faced a short life, however. The approaching summer meant the breakup of the pack ice where the camp now found itself. Daily measurements of the ice beneath their feet revealed a steady melting already, which had reduced the pack thickness from 3 feet to 14 inches. Bew figured they had maybe 2 more weeks before he and his 4-man team would be forced to disassemble the camp and wait for evacuation by Twin Otter ski plane. The Arctic oceanographer trudged through ankle-deep snow toward the radio shack. Over the blowing rustle of ice particles bounding across the ground, he heard the whine of a diesel engine revving up and down. Looking past the camp's structures, he spotted a yellow front-end track loader racing back and forth, its blunt blade piling up high mounds of drifted snow. The plow was keeping clear a 500-foot ice runway that stretched along the back of the camp. The crude landing strip was the camp's lifeline, allowing Twin Otters to bring in food and supplies on a weekly basis. Bew made sure that the makeshift runway was kept clear at all times. Ignoring the roving track loader, Bew entered the joint lab and radio hut, shaking the snow off his feet in an inner doorway before entering the main structure. Making his way past several cramped bays full of scientific journals and equipment, he turned into a closet-sized cubby that housed the satellite radio station. A wild-eyed man with sandy hair and a mirthful grin looked up from the radio set. Scott Case was a brilliant physicist who specialized in studying solar radiation at the poles. Like everyone else in the camp, Case wore multiple hats, including that of chief communications operator.
"Atmospherics are playing havoc with our radio signals again," he said to Bew. "Satellite reception is nil and our ground transmitter is little better."
"I'm sure the approaching storm isn't helping matters any," Bew replied.
"Does Tuktoyaktuk even know that we're trying to hail them?"
Case shook his head.
"Can't tell for sure, but I've detected no callbacks."
The sound of the track loader shoving a load of ice just outside the structure echoed off the thin walls.
"You keeping the field clean just in case?" he asked Bew.
"Tuktoyaktuk has us scheduled for a supply drop later today. They may not know that we'll be in the middle of a gale-force blizzard in about an hour. Keep trying, Scott. See if you can wave off the flight for today, for the safety of the pilots."
Before Case could transmit again, the radio suddenly cackled. An authoritative voice backed by static interference blared through the speaker. "Ice Research Lab 7. Ice Research Lab 7, this is NUMA Research Vessel Narwhal. Do you read? Over."
Bew beat Case to the transmitter and replied quickly.
"Narwhal, this is Dr. Kevin Bew of Ice Research Lab 7. Go ahead, please."
"Dr. Bew, we're not trying to eavesdrop, but we've heard your repeated calls to the Coast Guard station at Tuktoyaktuk, and we've picked up a few unanswered calls back from Tuktoyaktuk. It sounds like the weather is keeping you two from connecting. Can we assist in relaying a message for you?
We'd be most grateful.
Bu had the American ship forward a message to Tuktoyaktuk to delay sending the supply plane for 24 hours on account of the poor weather. A few minutes later, the Narwhal radioed a confirmation back from Tuktoyaktuk.
Our sincere thanks, Bu radioed. That will save some poor flyboy a rough trip.
Don't mention it. Where is your camp located, by the way?
Bu transmitted the latest position of the floating camp, and the vessel responded in kind.
Are you boys in good shape to ride out the approaching storm?
Looks to be a mean one, the Narwhal radioed.
We've managed everything the Good Witch of the North has thrown at us so far, but thanks all the same, Bu replied.
Farewell, Ice Lab 7. Narwhal out.
Bu set down the transmitter with a look of relief.
Who says the Americans don't belong in the Arctic after all, he said to Case, then slipped on his parka and left the building.
35 miles to the southwest, Captain Bill Stenseth examined a local meteorological forecast with studious concern. An imposing man with Scandinavian features and the build of an NFL linebacker, Stenseth had weathered storms in every ocean of the world. Yet facing a sudden blow in the ice-studded Arctic still made the veteran captain of the Narwhal nervous.
The wind seems to be ratcheting up a bit in the latest forecast, he said, without looking up from the document. I think we're in for a pretty good gale.
Wouldn't want to be those poor saps hunkered down on the ice, he added, pointing toward the radio.
Standing beside Stenseth on the ship's bridge, Rudy Gunn suppressed a pained grin. Sailing through the teeth of a powerful Arctic storm was going to be anything but a pleasantry. He would gladly trade places with the ice camp members, who would likely sit out the storm in a warm hut playing pinochle, Gunn thought. Stenseth's preference for battling the elements at sea was clearly the mark of a lifelong sailor, one who never felt comfortable with his feet on the shore. Gunn shared no similar propensity. Though he was an Annapolis graduate who had spent several years at sea, he now spent more time sailing a desk. The deputy director for the National Underwater and Marine Agency, Gunn was usually found in the headquarters building in Washington, D.C. With a short, wiry build and horn-rimmed glasses on his nose, he was the physical opposite of Stenseth. Yet he shared the same adventurous pursuit of oceanographic challenges and was often on hand when a new vessel or piece of underwater technology was sea-tested for the first time.
I'd have more pity for the polar bears, Gunn said.
How long before the storm front arrives?
Stenseth eyed a growing number of white caps cresting off the ship's bow.
About an hour. No more than two. I would suggest retrieving and securing the Bloodhound within the next 30 minutes.
They won't like returning to the kennel so soon.
I'll head down to the operations room and pass the word. Captain, please let me know if the weather deteriorates any sooner than predicted.
Stenseth nodded as Gunn left the bridge and made his way aft. The 200-foot research ship was rolling steadily through a building sea, and Gunn had to grasp a handrail several times to steady himself. Nearing the stern, he looked down at a large moon pool cut through the vessel's hull. Surface water was already sloshing back and forth, spilling onto the surrounding deck. Stepping down a companionway, he entered a door marked Lab, which opened up into a large bay. At the far end was a sectioned area with numerous video monitors mounted on the bulkhead. Two technicians sat tracking and recording a data feed from underwater.
Are they on the bottom? Gunn asked one of the technicians.
Yes, the man replied. They're about 2 miles east of us. Actually crossed the border into Canadian waters, as a matter of fact.
Do you have a live transmission?
The man nodded and passed his communication headset to Gunn.
Bloodhound, this is Narwhal. We're seeing a rapid deterioration in the weather conditions up here. Request you break off survey and return to the surface.
A long pause followed Gunn's transmission, and then a static-filled reply was heard.
Roger, Narwhal, came a gruff voice with a Texas accent. Breaking off survey in 30 minutes. Bloodhound, over and out.
Gunn started to reply, then thought better of it. It was pointless to argue with the pair of hardheads at the other end, he thought.
Yanking off the headset, he silently shook his head, then sank into a high-backed chair and waited for the half hour to pass.